Marshall to call the next case, please.
Cambria Company LLC versus M&amp;M Creative Laminates.
And thank you to all council for being here early. It was, you kind of got the drill in terms of what happens, and you know how the podium works. So without anything else being said, appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Your Honors. Leland Shermer for appellant M&amp;M Creative Laminates, and appearing pro se for myself in the matter concerning the protective order. This case is one where three very significant claims were dismissed by Judge Abrams at summary judgment. The first count of the counterclaim by M&amp;M was for violation of the Minnesota Franchise Act. This case involves two businesses involved in manufacturing and distributing countertops for home remodeling and new construction. Cambria, located here in Minnesota, manufactures 6-foot by 10-foot, 1,200-pound slabs and sells those as commodities everywhere in North America. There are five cities where Cambria has separately invested millions of dollars to build very substantial fabrication shops, what it calls fab shops. And in those five cities, Cambria has dozens of employees, millions of dollars worth of industrial equipment. And what happens in those cities is that if you are a business partner of Cambria near one of those cities, you are not allowed to purchase the commodity, the slab, and do the cutting, called fabrication, on your own. Instead, Cambria essentially has what we might call in an antitrust setting, they have tied the purchase of slabs to the purchase of fabrication services for those five markets. And when I asked Cambria's second ever employee and CFO, Jim Ward, why did Cambria start building their own fab shops in these locations? He said, economics. I said, are you saying that the building of these fab shops was done because Cambria can make profit doing the fabrication as well? He said, sure. So this fabrication is no minor matter. It is not de minimis. It is significant. And in fact, for the partners of Cambria near these five fab shops, it is the essence of the relationship. I asked Mr. Ward during his deposition, and these materials were submitted in opposition to the summary judgment motion, I asked, how much does the material cost alone when a partner of Cambria buys a whole slab? And he said, on average, $22 a square foot. And I said, well, what if Cambria takes that 6-foot by 10-foot, 1,200-pound slab and does the initial what they call rough cut, where they cut it from how it's manufactured to the size that might go in your kitchen? And he said, that's $55 a foot. And I said, why is there $33 a foot increased price? He said, because we charge for fabrication. And then I said, well, what about cutting out holes and doing the edges and polishing? Every one of those items is a separate fabrication charge that is imposed on partners near the fab shops, like M&M. M&M was near what they call the Kent fab shop. It's located halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh. Cleveland and Pittsburgh are only about 2 hours apart, and they built one of these five there.
These points are all in support of your argument that this is a franchise. There is a franchise fee that was paid.
Absolutely, because the franchise statute says that a franchise fee can be any payment for goods or services. And then the legislature saw fit to include carve-outs, okay, except the following.
Before we get to all of the carve-outs, for payment for goods or services, one issue, and that's where you're arguing all of these separate fabrication fees that were attached. Do you agree that the training that M&N had where they came to Minnesota and had training, that is that on the table or is that off the table?
No, that's on the table. The issue there is,
are you saying there was a cost to that?
Well, there was a cost to M&M, but it was not paid to Cambria. That's undisputed fact. And Cambria's contention. Now, the statute doesn't say where the payment has to go. The whole point of these franchise statutes is that if an independent family, a small business, creates a franchise And they are investing in their own business, as M&M clearly did here. That was the whole key. You had to invest in this business that you're protected from random terminations where you are doing what you're supposed to be doing. And M&M...
Can I ask a question about your reference to payment for goods and services? I'm aware that there are several design shops in the Twin Cities to which you can go and order Cambria countertops. Are you saying every one of those shops that will sell a Cambria countertop is in a franchise agreement with Cambria?
Not necessarily. The vast majority...
In this case, different than that.
Because throughout North America, Cambria sells the entire slab to the fabricators. Those are separate companies. They make the money on doing the fabrication. But Cambria built these five fab shops in North America that cost them millions of dollars. And Cambria's deal for people near those, like M&M, was that M&M had to buy not only the material, but also had to buy the fabrication from Cambria.
So, Counsel, I'd just like to back up a little bit with, in terms of understanding your argument. This, the arrangement you're describing, you know, the fact that you were going to, your arrangement with Cambria to buy through the fab shops and pay Cambria for a fabricated product, that's reflected, isn't it, in the contract that was entered into between M&M and Cambria?
No, the contract's completely silent about the requirement that Cambria's senior executives all admitted, and my client in an affidavit said, it's silent about the fabrication being a requirement.
Right, when you say it's silent, it is silent on a number of things, but when your company issues a purchase order, they're asking for a particular product, and it's the fabricated product, right?
My client submitted engineering drawings.
That arrangement, that's what you were going to request from Cambria and that's what Cambria was going to deliver.
Yes, because that's the nature of the arrangement. We had to buy material and fabrication.
8 years.
That went on for many years. Right. Every fabrication charge was separately invoiced. But that was the nature of this deal, and that was unique to these five fabrication shops.
Why is that so important if they were separately invoiced? I mean, fabrication is fabrication. So inclusively, exclusively, you're saying let's not say it's fabrication and let's treat these as all sorts of constellation charges.
No, I'm just pointing that out as a fact. These are services. We had the declaration, the expert report, and then the affidavit of Cecilia Dixon from Pittsburgh, who looked at Cambria's procurement of two separate federal trademark and service mark registrations. One was for services, for fabrication, for installation by others. Cambria represented to the U.S. government under oath, under penalty of perjury, that it sold separate fabrication services for installation by others. That's exactly what M&M did. And the timing, you have to list on a trademark application when you first started providing those services. The date that Cambria listed in their federal trademark or service mark registration was tied to the opening of the fabrication shops, not to the manufacture of the slabs. They had a separate trademark application, which a trademark applies to a good, a service mark applies to a service. They had a separate trademark application on the sale of fabricated material.
Counsel, thank you so much for that explanation of the background and the facts and evidence in the case. I'd like you to tie it, if you would, to the statute that you're seeking to make a claim out of, because that's, as you said, you know, one of the most important decisions that the district court made was granting summary judgment against you under the Minnesota Franchise Act, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So the argument that I didn't see an answer to, and I see it in respondent's brief, and I might have just missed your analysis, so help me out, has to do with the statutory definition of franchise fee, including that the following shall not be considered as a payment for a franchise fee: the purchase of goods or an agreement to purchase goods at a bona fide wholesale price. Now, you have described the services. You call that, you know, that fabrication involves a service. It is certainly a finishing of a product, something beyond a raw material, certainly. But if it's sold at a bona fide wholesale price to M&M, it seems to me then that product does not fall under the MFA. Now, help me out. I know you disagree, so why do you disagree?
The fabrication service is a service. The statute defines a franchise fee as including any payment for a good or a service. What you're referencing, Judge Bratvold, is the carve-out for goods, for the materials. If Cambria sold at 20...
It doesn't say material. It says
goods. Well, the material is the good here.
Well, is it? I mean, because as you said, Cambria is selling this countertop in a couple of different ways within your area. And again, it's the agreement you signed on to and repeatedly signed on to with your purchase orders. In your area, that product was fabricated. So it was something beyond a raw material.
Well, it was the purchase of a good and a service. My client could have purchased those same materials from other suppliers without being required to buy the fabrication. So the statute talks about a payment for a good or service. Fabrication, by Cambria's own admission before the Federal Trademark Office under penalty of perjury, was a separate commercial stream. It had its own life. That's why Jim Ward, the CFO, said, we built those facilities because they were independent profit centers. So Cambria chose to do business that way. My client agreed to do business that way. But that doesn't make it any less so that there were two separate purchases. It's like when you get new brakes at Pep Boys.
So let me be more direct. Does the evidence reflect that M&M purchased this product from Cambria at a bona fide wholesale price? And if not, why not?
Well, Your Honor, we maintain there are two separate things. As to the product, we are not fighting whether the material alone may have been at a bona fide wholesale price. But we say these are very separate matters in the industry. The fabrication was a required purchase.
From the invoice you paid, M&M pays to Cambria, what was your markup when you sell the product on? What does the record reflect?
What was M&M's markup?
Correct. I mean, the statement made in respondent's brief is 100%.
So yeah, it was roughly around there, but... You have to remember, Your Honor, that the services were all separately billed items. It's like when you get your brakes repaired, you pay for time and labor. Those are two different things. Do you get your car back? Yes. Does it have new brakes? Yes. Did you pay for a good and a service? Absolutely. There's
so
no question.
That's how these invoices looked?
Yes.
To M&M?
They're attached. One sample is attached to the affidavit of Ronald Gardner, along with a 611-page document that we had submitted. If I could move on to some of the other issues in the interest of time. There is no question that Cambria's motion for summary judgment did not seek dismissal of counts 4 or 5. Instead, as its brief identified and as the proposed order makes clear, what Cambria sought on M&M's counterclaims was, quote, count 1, breach of franchise agreement, count 3, unjust enrichment, and count 6, declaratory judgment of defendant's counterclaims are dismissed with prejudice. They did not ask that counts 4 and 5 be dismissed. They did ask that the liability limitation provision in the party's business partner agreement is effective, enforceable, and defendant is precluded from seeking and recovering damages within the scope of those liability limitation provisions, including but not limited to consequential lost profit damages. M&M argued in opposition to that particular aspect of the motion for partial summary judgment that the provision was not enforceable for two separate reasons. One, it was unconscionable due to its breadth, and the second was that if this is a franchise relationship, the franchise regulations expressly prohibit the attempt to limit remedies to a franchisee. Judge Abrams never addressed the second one because he found it wasn't a franchise. But as to the first one, Cambria responded to M&M's argument by saying, quote, Cambria does not argue that M&M waived recovery of all damages. Cambria seeks to preclude recovery of consequential damages, including lost profits. While M&M's damage interrogatory answer lists 20 categories of damages, only one of which appears to be lost profits or consequential damages. So what Cambria sought was essentially a declaratory judgment that the limitation of liability provision would be enforceable according to its terms. Its terms include the language that says that this is only enforceable against claims arising out of the BPA. Counts 4 and 5 for interference with customers and for misappropriation of confidential information, they all took place after the termination. Your Honor, lastly, this sanctions motion, the ITC testimony of Jim Ward has been argued by Cambria to be identical to what was in Special Master Vanden Noort's order that I had provided to another lawyer. If it's identical, the ITC testimony nobody's contesting is public testimony. So how can that be a violation? The Federal Circuit, which deals with these issues all the time, issued a recent opinion, it's cited in our reply, that says where the issue is questionable, as it is here, the court should not find there was a violation. So we ask that that be overturned as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shermer.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Long. I represent Cambria on this appeal. The business relationship between M&M and Cambria was for the purchase by M&M of a finished good. It was for Cambria quartz countertops or vanities that M&M would then resell to end users and would go out and install. That is the business relationship here. What was purchased was a finished good. And thus, by purchasing a finished good, this falls clearly within the explanation that a franchise fee under Subdivision 9 of ADC 01 does not include a good purchased at a bona fide wholesale price.
So I understood the argument is there's all this other stuff added to the good purchased, the add-ons, the fees that are separate and apart. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So the argument is that because this is a finished product that is customized to M&M's customers' need, that somehow that converts this into a bifurcated service fee plus purchase. There's no bifurcation because what is being purchased is the good itself. And so it isn't as if M&M purchases the slabs and then has them fabricated. What M&M does is purchase the finished good. The fact that there's line items to show the purchaser what the specific charges are has nothing to do with whether there's a separate fee for services here. The example in M&M's brief about going into, I think it was Pep Boys for Brakes, is a bad one because there, first off, you don't have a business relationship with the distributor. But secondly, the more applicable car-related example would be purchasing an automobile from a dealer. And there, you're purchasing the car, but you have different line items for tinted windows or for power seats or different things. I don't think you can argue that those are added services. What's being purchased is the finished good, the finished car. The Minnesota Franchise Act has been in existence for over 50 years. There is no case, and to my knowledge, no argument in a case that holds or argues that a finished good that has to be fabricated or something has to be done to it somehow has a service fee that takes you outside of the wholesale goods exception. The wholesale goods at a bona fide, yes.
I appreciate that we're missing case law on that point. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is reading through this definition of a franchise fee, it does say, you know, as argued ably by the appellant's counsel, does say that a franchise fee means any payment for goods or services. Now, I'm trying to remember whether there are other references to services, but I think that's the key phrase there, where your emphasis is on sub A, this sort of carve out or exclusion from what is a franchise fee, says the purchase of goods or an agreement to purchase goods at a bona fide wholesale price is not considered a franchise fee. So that's what you're resting on. Now A only describes goods. And I think appellant's argument is that franchise fee does include payments for services, and the carve-out is only for payments of goods. So he's trying to very carefully slice and dice between what is a good and what is a service. So if we're supposed to do that, if the legislature's asking us to do that, how do we do that in light of the facts of this case?
So under the facts of this case, there's no separate fee for services, number one. What's being purchased is a good. There's nothing separate. Secondly, there's much case law, which is cited in our brief, that goes to that payments that are ordinary business expenses, or expenses that are incidental or part of the relationship, ordinary business expenses do not constitute a fee. And finally, with respect to the services fee argument, the only case that ever addressed, to my knowledge, the service fee issue was the Martin Advisors case. And in Martin Advisors, it's done in one sentence with a footnote. And in Martin Advisors, you had a $10,000 upfront cash payment. You had 1% share of loan proceeds. You had clearly what is a basic franchise fee. I mean, the statute talks about an upfront payment. It talks about royalty payments. It's clear we don't have either of those here. And in Martin Advisors,
Martin Advisors doesn't have this type of fact situation either.
Absolutely,
right?
And yeah. I was okay. going to get to that. It doesn't talk about finished goods. What it does talk about is that for use of the computer service, which was the part of this franchise relationship, there was a $400 fee that the franchisee had to pay each time it used it. That's a service fee under the Act. Buying a finished good that has line items so that it can be customized so that M&M can sell the product, that is not a service
fee. Your own BPA didn't have an upfront fee in your BPA, your agreement.
There's no upfront fee.
No upfront fee. You didn't get any percentage of any of their sales?
No royalty, absolutely not. And to follow up on your question with respect to whether training fees are in this, to be clear, the training that M&M attended was paid for by Cambria, and that's what the record states. And there's case law that says costs of attendance as far as transportation, travel, those do not constitute franchise fees, and that case is in our brief. I'd like to turn to count 4 and 5.
Let me ask you one question before you get there. You also make the alternative argument that the MFA is inapplicable because M&M's not a Minnesota resident, and that certainly was an issue that was briefed to the district court, never ruled on finally by the district court. But you can bring it up on appeal if you like.
Yes.
I mean, if we agree with you on the franchise fee issue, is it necessary for the court to reach this?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And that was the first thing I wanted to say, was that it's only if you were to find that otherwise this is a franchise, then that we would get to this alternative argument. And I think we lay it out briefly, but sufficiently in the brief. But absolutely, you do not have to go there in deciding this case. If we could move to count 4 and 5, the guts of counsel's argument is that Cambria did not seek summary judgment with respect to counts 4 and 5. And to refer to the record, and we point this out in our brief, that's just simply incorrect. In Cambria's summary judgment statement of issues, docket 338 at page 2, statement of issue 4 says, quote, "Is summary judgment warranted on counts 1 through 5 of M&M's counterclaim based upon the liability provisions in the BPA and their exclusion of consequential loss, profits, damages?" It is clearly stated at the beginning of the brief that Cambria was seeking summary judgment. And there's repeated arguments from M&M that we were not. And frankly, I just don't understand it. With respect to the footnote in Cambria's reply and summary judgment, where Cambria said, and counsel referred to this, that we were only seeking exclusion of lost profits damages, and that in the interrogatory answers there were many other types of damages. That's very true, but those damages didn't relate to counts 4 or 5. Counts 4 or 5 were talking about lost profits and future lost profits. And at their complaint, when you look at counts 4 and 5, which I believe is docket number 9, in the prayer for relief at paragraph 147, account 4, it says M&M seeks damages, including but not limited to lost profits and lost future profits. The same goes to the unfair competition. At no point in time, at either summary judgment or any of the briefing, has M&M been able to articulate that for the tortious interference claim, count 4, or the unfair competition, which is essentially a trade secrets claim, count 5, did they ever articulate how there could be damages that they were seeking other than lost profits? And thus the...
So
these,
counsel,
yes.
I just want to move ahead. So let's, you know, ask an isolated question about counts 4 and 5 and the way the district court handled those on summary judgment. So even if there was error in that, as you pointed out at some great detail in your brief, the final damages instruction that was given to the jury did allow the jury to consider lost profits, did allow the jury, M&M's lost profits, did allow the jury to consider Cambria's use of customer information from M&M.
It absolutely did.
And so this, it seems to me that these damages were submitted to the jury. We have a verdict on it. Isn't any error harmless? And I'm just trying to see why it wouldn't be. And I'm sure counsel for appellant will tell me why in his rebuttal.
Well, I would agree with you that that any error was harmless, and I would expand upon that by just pointing out the fact that there was extensive testimony and evidence presented by M&M trying to expand upon the themes of the tortious interference claim, arguing that based upon all the information that Cambria had accumulated during the 8-year relationship, that they had turned around and used that to go out and get the customers. And there was a great amount of testimony on that. And the damage instruction over our objection, because our view is that you don't get lost profits in an equitable recoupment claim, but Judge Abrams disagreed.
Right, that issue's not
in front
of us,
all in front of the court.
Right? You haven't raised that issue about whether lost profits are...
No, we haven't.
Right.
Okay. So that is not appeal.
We're just going to take that.
Yes.
All right, so go ahead with your answer.
As we have. And so the answer is yes, it would be harmless.
I'm also going to try to move it along a little
bit.
Time runs out so quick, and I want to hear your argument as to the attorney's fees and the Rule 68 offer for judgment, as well as the sanction that was imposed.
Okay. So on Rule 68 offer of judgment, the rule provides that you make an offer to allow judgment to be entered to the effect specified in the offer. That's 6801A. What was offered here was a takeaway, what was a walkaway on both sides. There is no case law that says that that is not within the scope of 68.01.
Does that need to be something addressed as a precedential ruling by this court? If you're saying there's nothing that addresses that?
No. What I'm saying is that there's nothing that supports... no case law that would support that such an offer does not fall within 68.01. On its face, it was clear that the result would be that there would be all claims would be dismissed. That's what the offer was, and that falls within an offer.
Thorough offer.
It was on both sides. I mean, both sides had claims, and there's just no support that that is improper. And the court concluded that the net effect was to Cambria prevailing with about $211,000, and clearly then that M&M would have been in a better position if they had accepted the offer. So clearly Rule 68 applies. With respect to attorney's fees, The argument there is that the contract says that the account is placed for collection. The undersigned agrees to pay all costs and expenses of collection, including attorney's fees, court costs, and expenses. There is no reasonable interpretation of that language that an account is placed for collection means that you have to go through a collection agency. It doesn't say a collection agency. It says placed for collection. Attorneys seek collection on behalf of bad debts or amounts due all the time. It doesn't matter whether one individual would think, well, maybe this only applies to collection agencies. On the reasonable interpretation is that it certainly includes a lawsuit to collect. With respect to sanctions, the focus of the sanctions was not disclosure of testimony before the ITC. The focus of two judges, former Judge Vandenorth and Judge Abrams, both of whom saw the evidence in front of them and is subject to an abuse of discretion standard. The issue was that Mr. Ward had testified in this case that sales had been gradually increasing. That was what was in Judge Special Masters Vandenorth's statement on the record. The testimony from Mr. Ward was designated as confidential on May 9th, and the disclosure then was on May 16th. So to answer your question, the focus of the sanctions motion was that Mr. Ward had testified in this case that sales were increasing, not anything that was disclosed with the ITC. And you can see that at the addendum 18 through 21, where the Special Master Vandenorth's order is listed. I see my time is out.
It has. Thank you, Mr. Long.
Thank you.
And Mr. Shermer, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. The fabrication services, it is undisputed, on a typical job that M&M had are about 75% of what M&M was paying for. They are not de minimis. The statute does make the distinction that you pointed out, Judge Bradfold, and Martin Investors.
I'm not pointing out anything. I'm asking questions about the language of the statute. So I would love to hear your answer and how that language should be interpreted. Thank you.
Okay. The statute is broad. The Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly said it's broad, and they've even said the definition of a franchise fee is broad. Among the definitional language is any payment for a good or service. The Supreme Court in Martin Investors, footnote 8, found that when the franchisor was paid $400 to search a computer database, that was a service charge, and that the statute has no exclusions for service charges. The Supreme Court has answered that question for everyone. These service charges are significant. They're the essence of the relationship. It's like buying a cell phone and buying phone services. The phone services are often—
I have very little time in rebuttal, and I'm sure you want to get to the sanctions issue, but I just want to ask one more time. So the purchase order that M&M is placing is for the finished product, or at least as finished as it is, it was received by you, fabricated, correct?
It's for a combination of the material and the fabrication services. And that's what they bought.
If you want to say more.
Two questions on that point. Was there a specific fabrication fee that was charged for each and every counter that was ordered? Or did the fabrication fee vary based on size, edge, number of holes, etc.?
The answer is both. For the material, there was a $33 increase over the cost of the material alone. But if you got a new countertop in your kitchen, it would be dependent on how many sinks you have, whether it goes around a cooktop, whether it goes around a refrigerator.
Invoices did not separately delineate the cost of material, the cost of fabrication. Would you have this argument?
I think so. I think that's just a fact that reinforces that these are separate. Cambria's represented under oath to the federal government. These are two separate business lines, material and fabrication services. And that's borne out in the invoicing, because they are. Nowhere else in North America does anybody have to buy the fabrication services, except if you're near one of Cambria's FAM shops. You buy the whole slab, and you make the money on the fabrication. Now, this argument that in Cambria's summary judgment motion, they did seek summary judgment on counts 4 and 5, they did not seek dismissal of counts 4 and 5. What I argued was they did seek summary judgment about the enforceability of the liability limitation provision, but they did not seek dismissal of the counts. Judge Abrams, sua sponte, just did that. And I respectfully disagree with my colleague at the bar that the list of damages in M&M's interrogatory did not include damages under counts 4 and 5. They most certainly did. Your Honor asked about the fact that the judge allowed some of the evidence concerning unfair competition and interference with contracts to come in. He did instruct the jury under his substitute theory of recoupment that the measure of damages for recoupment is only the unreimbursed expenses. And when he did that, that made it the fact that he included the events that pertain to the interference with contract and unfair competition, the jury followed his instruction. He told them, for the pending jobs, you can award for the pending jobs. The testimony was there was $44,000 in pending jobs, and the jury did that. But by virtue of the fact that he put it under this theory of recoupment, it made the claims truncated in a massive way, because everybody knows that on recoupment, it's just you get your expense back. You don't get the other remedies that unfair competition and interference with contract provides. So they are not, it's not a no harm, no foul situation in the least. Your Honor, I think that when you look at the sanctions matter here, there are three documents that are pertinent. The testimony at the ITC, everybody agrees it was public. The testimony at the deposition, and Mr. Vandenort's ruling, which was recorded by a court reporter. Cambria pounded throughout the motion practice that when Mr. Vandenort said that Mr. Ward's testimony was inconsistent between the ITC and the deposition, that he was wrong, that he testified exactly the same at the ITC and in his deposition. So the information that is in the transcribed ruling of Mr. Vandenort is exactly what's in the ITC transcript, according to Cambria's own position. And we didn't challenge that. The context for this matter was that we had served an interrogatory asking what were Cambria's sales, because one of the grounds for termination that Cambria alleged was that M&M's sales weren't keeping up with Cambria's sales. So we asked, what were your sales? They wouldn't produce it.
We, of course, will review the record. Your time has run out. If you need to summarize anything, go ahead.
Your Honor, this is a significant issue. This put my family business client in bankruptcy. There was a termination with no notice. What Cambria did here, which unfortunately they do in other settings, is unreasonable, and this court is being asked to carefully review its voluminous record and find that there were a lot of mistakes made. The matter should be reversed and sent back for a new trial on all of these issues. Thank you very much for your time.
Counsel, thank you for the briefing. It was excellent briefing, as well as the arguments that were presented today. They are very helpful. A decision will be issued within the statutory time frame, 90 days. Thank you very much.